maybe a show of hands or just a rally of the eyes. It seems common to have friends with whom you wish you would spend more time, that every time you see them, you think, I'd like to see this person more often, and then it never happens. Right? Common experience. So I was just such a friend yesterday, an African-American man who's a senior leader at an academic institution, and we got to telling stories of subtle and implicit racism. He had some good ones, and I told one I just remembered from my high school football team. Shocking as it may be that I played high school football. So towards the end of the freshman season, our coach, who was a screamer, was giving out sort of impromptu superlatives. And I remember because I got most improved. It's really is just a nice way of saying, you stank when you got here. And we were a suburban Boston school, which meant we were part of a legacy of a busing institution. So we had some African-American students from the city who were part of our community. And one, Carlton, was on the team. And the coach said, you're the most athletic. And I, even at 14, I knew that Carlton was far from the best player on the team. He was really right in the middle of quality of players on the team. And I don't know if I clocked it then, but it was so clearly racism. Maybe not explicit, maybe this coach would have not said so explicitly or understood himself to be a racist, but there are understandings and biases that pervade us at all times. Towards the end of this sermon, I'm going to come clean about one that I've been reckoning with in my own self, but I want to take a detour first. So we get in the parsha, Parshat Ekev, the command that our heart, or the injunction that our heart not grow haughty, that we not become arrogant in our success as we conquer the land. So the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic revival movement some 300 years ago or so, notices that the Torah repeatedly warns against pride and extols humility, humbleness of Moses, for example. Yet, nowhere is this precept counted as a mitzvah. Why isn't it a mitzvah to be humble? Baal Shem Tov pauses and answers, if humility were a mitzvah, the ego of a person would surely count it among achievements. As I think it was Henny Youngman who said, sincerity is the most important thing. If you can fake that, you've got it made. So we are reckoned, look who's being so humble. We are reckoned once again in this parasha with what I would term the test of wealth. There are a couple of parshiot where we are warned when things go good for you, that will be somewhat counterintuitively your greatest temptation to be led astray from your faith and your experience and your practice. And the Talmud describes this as the phenomena of a fat ox kicks. When the oxen or the donkey who is satisfied most is inclined to misbehave the worst. I'm not sure if that's true, but that was their aphorism. So we're told, among other places, the injunction, the mitzvah, the talk of Birkat HaMazon, that we ought eventually bless our food after we consume it, and it comes from the line in chapter 8, verse 9 and 10, Ve'achalta v'savata, that you will eat and be satisfied. That this is, again, a preview of the test of success. And I've spoken before about the, at least up until recently, the growing and burgeoning success of the Jewish community in wealth, in integration, in educational attainment, in places of repute. And we are entering a period where that is, of course, challenged along with our loyalty. It's not exactly what I want to talk about, but I do want to address not in terms of anti-Semitism or blaming the victim, but the understanding that we as a community of success and sometimes of privilege need to be mindful of our success and use it for the benefit of humankind. So early in our parasha, we're told that God doesn't take bribes, which Rashi, the medieval commentator, understands to mean God doesn't care about wealth, implying that humans do. It's very easy to be mesmerized by the wealthy. It's very easy, my father would point out, that for a wealthy person to think he or she is not only skilled and talented in the endeavor of their occupation, but ought give advice on many different endeavors. Though Andrew Yang seems to have some wisdom beyond his success. And the true danger of success, says our tradition, I've noted to you before that there's a great moral danger embedded in the Torah, and that is to do what you think is right. To every man for himself in terms of what he or she understands to be the moral life. That there is an idea of what they call heteronomous morality, that there is morality that transcends us, and our goal is to live according to God's morality, or as some later would call it, natural law. And not to fall prey to the idea that we are the arbiters of morality, success, or wisdom. And that's made explicit in the parsha this week, where in chapter 8, slightly later on, it says that you might be seduced to saying, my power and the might of my hand made this wealth for me. Going back, I think, to the 2012 election where there was debate over you didn't make the wealth yourself. You know, you benefited from lighthouses and expressways and infrastructure that society as a whole constructs. And that tension, where does wealth come from and how much is earned or owed or inherent to a person? Because, says the Torah, God gives you the power to derive your wealth. So to foreshadow the prejudicial ism to which I fall prey, and I think many fall prey, elitism. I think when we are successful, and I'm looking around the room and in a Jewish community, many of us are financially successful, successful in educational attainment, successful in our zip code or in our marriage, successful in our stability. We tend to think that it's deserved because it's, frankly, psychologically much easier than understanding that there is a huge component of randomness in life. And medieval commentators Sforno from the 16th century Italy and Bachia from 11th century Spain addressed this concept that you will think that your wealth was got by your own hand. And among the images they offer is you might attribute it to the goodwill of idols, or you would ascribe it to your horoscope. I think implicit in that second idea is a partial understanding. If you think about horoscope as just the fates of birth, what zip code, what race, what nationality you were born into, what era you were born into, there's a beginning understanding that there is some measure, some modicum of luck just in initial position. John Rawls talks about that. You know, there was a rabbi at the seminary who, when asked what era he would like to live in, he said, well, of course, this one. In any other era, I would have died of tuberculosis. Right? So we're lucky to be alive in this era, to be Americans, to be, whether you're, you know, especially lucky as a Caucasian male, born into the gender that you know yourself to be, whatever those questions are, we all have some measure of luck inherent in just the zip code of our birth, the hospital we were born to. But it's a real trip. I can only speak for myself. I don't want to fault anyone else. Maybe I'm making a sort of kapara or preventive tshuva to address, I think, the fault I have, but I know is shared. Elitism. This thought that we are better than others simply because we have a master's degree simply because we pay a mortgage, simply because our car is paid off. And the Orchot Tzadikim, who was a German in the 15th century, addresses this. I was flabbergasted that this is addressed over half a millennia ago. So I'll read in long quote to you. There's a type that mocks the words of people, for he holds them in contempt because they did not prosper in money matters or in attainment of honor, and he makes fun of the poor. We know this to be true to our age. Not that he accuses them of any defect necessarily, they are simply despicable to his eyes, and this comes about because of arrogance, or at times because the scoffer has ease and too much pleasure, the trial of success. One who laughs at a poor person because she or he is poor does so because it seems to him that the one is poor because of a lack of wisdom, while he himself is rich because of his wisdom, and then says, "My power and the might of my hand got me this wealth." But, suggests the Orchot Tzadikim, don't forget that this poor man too is a work of the Creator, and when we scoff at our fellow human, we are inevitably, or in effect, scoffing at the Creator, scoffing at the Almighty. In this era, this busy era, this eventful era of rising anti-Semitism, increasingly pervasive racism, we can be immune to or blind to our own isms, our own biases, our own elitism, our own superiority that we might feel as Jews. It's dangerous. There's always pitfalls. And we ought not to think ourselves immune from scoffing at a person who is rural or has not received an associate's degree, different looking than us, speak a different language, speak a different accent. I will tell you, I hate to say this out loud, but I think it's a known thing that Northerners think Southerners are stupid, right? That y'all are yokels. Bull hockey. I can think of two people who are through and through Southerners in my sphere of influence, and one of them is a brilliant attorney, and the other, despite not having much formal education, knows things that I don't even know how to look up and makes jokes so quickly and so wittily that I'm dazzled by his intellect on a regular basis. We misapprehend or underestimate others at our peril. And so I want to return to the very first verse of the Torah reading we read, one of my favorite verses in the entire Torah, Deuteronomy 10:12. So it presages that the verse from Micah that you should walk humbly with your God. So the Akedat Yitzhak, I think writing probably 100 to 200 years ago, thinks again of this issue of the potential, the elitist potential that you might think you are deserving of all that you have. And you feel yourself, says he, that you ought to be the master of your own fate. And so God enjoins us at the very beginning of this parasha, at the very beginning of our reading, that is, V'ata Yisrael, Adonai Elohecha shoel mimach, ki im lera'a et Adonai Elohecha lalechet b'chol drachav, ulava oto, ulavod et Adonai Elohecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha. Now, Israel, what is this thing that God, your God, asks of you? Simply to revere God, to walk in God's ways, and to love God, serving God with all your heart and spirit. Don't forget this principle, I think, is what it's saying. Even if there is a valid social hierarchy, right? You might be more successful materially than your neighbor. The problem with this is God's up here. This is irrelevant from that perspective. And so we're enjoined to revere and serve and love God as partly a reminder that we are just blessed with the grace of having whatever we have at the moment.